In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
You betcha. Alan Adams of The Main Edge joining us for Pass the Popcorn. Happy Monday there, Mr. Adams.
Hey, happy Monday to you.
Before we talk movies, I have to talk about your social media post last night. Was it really a year ago that we did the last focus group show?
I know, it's crazy to think about, isn't it?
But yeah.
No, we did one. We had a show on February 21st. We were at our home away from home, the Next Generation Theater, and our next scheduled one was March 13th. And you might recall that was right around the time that everything just sort of started falling apart. And so we pushed that one, and we just haven't been back since. It's kind of a bummer to think about.
Well, it is. I miss making stuff up with you goobers.
Right. It's. But it does feel like some sort of corner is being turned. It might be being turned very, very, very gradually, but a turn is happening. It feels that way.
Right.
So I'm just going to cross my fingers and hope that that continues.
We'll be back. We're down, but not out.
Absolutely.
All right. Now, you saw a lot of movies this weekend. My gosh.
I did. I saw a few.
Four of them on tap, and I have interest in all of them here, so I'm not sure. Where would you like to begin?
You know what? Let's start with one that I think your little guy actually might enjoy. It's a movie called Flora and Ulysses. It's a Disney movie currently streaming on Disney Plus. And it's based on a children's book from 2013 by a woman named Kate DiCamillo. It's directed by Lena Khan, and it's basically this sort of a family-friendly take on, well, you know what? It's kind of a take on the superhero genre, believe it or not. Only the thing is, the superhero is a squirrel, Rich.
Aww.
Yeah. So here's the deal. You've got a 10-year-old girl named Flora, played by an absolutely adorable youngster named Matilda Lawler. She loves superheroes, thanks in large part to the fact that her dad, George, played by Ben Schwartz, is a comic book artist, and like so, she's very fond of the characters that he has created. Although he's currently struggling, and she also, which we learn this through various voiceover narration, she also considers herself to be a cynic, which I find hysterical that a 10-year-old girl riding her bike is telling us what a cynic she is. But that's springing, at least in part, from her watching the marital struggles that are happening between her dad and her mom, a woman named Phyllis, who is a romance novelist who's dealing with writer's block. So that sets the scene. One day, Flora looks out and sees that a neighbor's, Roomba, I mean, you can't say Roomba, but it's a robot vacuum, has gotten out of the house and is running amok through her yard. So Flora goes out to try and help the woman, but the machine winds up knocking a squirrel out of a tree and sucking it up inside. But Flora is able to save the squirrel, but wouldn't you know it, as often happens in moments of great trauma, a hero is born. The experience has changed the squirrel for reasons that are never explained, and you know, I don't really care. But now the squirrel is sentient, like it can understand her, and it also may have other abilities. So Flora names him Ulysses, which is the brand name of the vacuum. And this is the point where Flora meets her neighbor's nephew, a boy named William, played by Benjamin Ainsworth. He's a boy her age who's staying with his aunt, and he's staying with her. And I can't for the life of me figure out why this was made a plot point, but even now thinking about it amuses me. He's staying with his aunt because he's suffering from hysterical blindness for reasons that are never adequately explained. The kid has hysterical blindness. It's such a weird drop in. It's exactly the sort of thing that makes a movie like this appeal to a person like me. But what often happens, Ulysses winds up revealing himself in an inappropriate place. At this point, in this case, a local diner, wherein he inadvertently wreaks havoc and causes a call to be made to animal control. And that's where we meet a rogue animal control officer with a squirrel vendetta named Miller, played by Danny Pudi of Community fame, who will stop at nothing to bring this creature to justice. And so Flora and Ulysses have to team up. Ulysses being the hero, Flora decides that she wants to be his sidekick. And so they have to overcome the forces conspiring against them, whether it's, you know, animal control officers or evil cats or familial uncertainty. And, you know, neither one can fully handle it all on their own. But when they pair up, they are a heck of a team. And, yeah, look, it's exactly what you want from a live-action Disney offering. Like, it's light, it's fun, and even the darker, the potentially darker stuff, like, you know, things like separation and stuff like that, is treated with a light touch. So the allows it to all kind of seem okay, which is, I think, really important when you're introducing those sorts of elements into this kind of kids movie. Like, it's not complicated, but it's just goofy and unabashedly so. And look, this isn't gonna shift any paradigms. Like, it's just an amiable kids movie, and in its refusal to pretend to be anything else, it actually winds up being pretty agreeable. Like, look, like, even the most hard-hearted adult will find this tolerable, and the youngsters out there are going to have a really good time. I mean, come on, man, it's a squirrel with superpowers. Like, yeah. Don't pretend like you're not curious. The cast is good, maybe a little overqualified. You got Ben Schwartz. The mom is played by Allison Hannigan, who's wonderful. Schwartz gets it. You know, Danny Pudi is really going for it. Like, kind of an ideal, like, kid movie villain, because, like, even when he tries to be sinister, he just kind of comes off as sort of ridiculous. And then we've got a couple of scenes from some other notable comic names. Kate Micucci is in a couple of these. Janine Garofalo has a cameo. She's in one scene as Phyllis's agent, and Rich, Bobby Moynihan is in this movie. He's a comic shop owner, and I swear to God, his name is Stanley, spelled S-T-A-N-L-E-E, Stanley.
Oh.
Like, that's what I'm talking about. Like, give me that stuff. And it should be noted that with Schwartz, Pudi, and Moynihan all in this movie, we have all three of Donald's nephews from the new DuckTales. So, you know, that's important to note. But yeah, like, look, it's family friendly, man. It's not stingy with the silliness, but it allows room for sincerity. It's lovely. The talented, the performers are clearly enjoying themselves. But, you know, it's not an all-timer by any stretch of the imagination, but it's a pretty good diversion, I would say.
All right, there you go. Flora and Ulysses, what's up next?
Let's talk about Blythe's Spirit, because I had heard some pretty negative stuff about this movie. For those who are unaware, Blythe's Spirit was a play first produced in 1941, written by the great Noel Coward. And it's been adapted to film very successfully in the past. And so, you know, it's one of those things where it's like, do we really need another Blythe's Spirit? And so I was apprehensive going into this one, but I recognize that, you know, there's a lot of pressure that comes when you reimagine, you know, sort of a beloved classic. Like, you have to do right by the extant fans, but you also have to update and accelerate it so it can find purchase with people who don't have that connection, you know. And it doesn't always work. And we've talked in the past, because we've seen a spate of these sort of stage to screen adaptations in recent months. It doesn't always go the way you want it to. And that's kind of where we're at with Blythe's Spirit. Now, it's perfect. It's perfectly fine. Like, it's better than I anticipated it was, considering the sort of kind of savage reviews that some folks had been dishing out about it. But it's, you know, it's, I mean, it's got a great cast. Dan Stevens, Isla Fisher, Leslie Mann, Judi Dench. You know, it's a great cast. And look, it doesn't live up to the pedigree, either in terms of the source material or of the ensemble that they put together. Like, some of the subtler aspects of Coward's work are lost in this particular translation. But they also take full advantage of the shift in medium, meaning that they can sort of embrace a much wider setting. Like you're not living in the dining room. Like you get to sort of travel a little bit, and that's beneficial. Now again, not nearly as good as it could have been, and probably should have been, but not as bad as those would have you as some people would have you believe. Quick sort of summation: it's 1937. We're in England. The award-winning crime novelist Charles Condamine, played by Dan Stevens, has been enlisted to adapt one of his books into a screenplay at the behest of the movie mogul father of his wife, Ruth, played by Isla Fisher. They've been married for 5 years. From the outside, things look great, but there's some trouble in paradise. He's struggling with writer's block and maybe perhaps pining for the memory of his deceased first wife a little bit. Charles decides he needs some outside inspiration, so he and Ruth and some of their friends head to the theater to see a performance by the spiritualist and medium Madame Arcati, played by Judi Dench. He winds up inviting her to join them at his home for a seance so they can attempt to contact the spirits of the dead. What he's trying to do is get a closer look at some of the tricks of the trade as far as spiritualism is concerned to sort of inform the story that he's working on. But what he gets is a little bit more than that. Because it turns out Madame Arcati, not actually a fraud, and so she manages to invoke an actual spirit, but not just any spirit, the ghost of Charles's first wife, Elvira, played by Leslie Mann. And as you might imagine, the presence of Elvira causes some consternation for Charles, not least because he's the only one who can see her. And then, well, Rich, hijinks ensue. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that this is a perfect adaptation. Obvious issues here. And I'll also cop to being predisposed to be a little bit more forgiving of this film than maybe some people are, due to an affinity for both staged screen adaptations and this particular play. Like, I'm a big fan of Blythe Spirit. I love this play. And so seeing it represented on screen, imperfectly, sure, but I still believe that there's value here. The director, Edward Hall, takes full advantage of the flexibility of film rather than the stage. Like, we're all over the English countryside. Like, we see the whole Condamine home, but we get to see opera houses and gardens and tennis courts, and we walk in the woods. Like, it's just this wonderful expansion of the world. But some of the screwball kind of sensibility gets lost. Like, I struggle to articulate just why it doesn't fully work. Like, talent-wise, the actors are more than up to it, but for whatever reason, the energy just never quite reaches the point that it needs to. And if you don't have that sort of madcap energy, like, some of the subtler laughs, you know, fade to the back. Now, the slapstick stuff works very well. However, if you're talking about a Noel Coward story and you're talking about physical comedy, then something has gone wrong.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, and you know, not blaming the cast. They're solid. Stevens and Fisher are a very striking pair. Like, they have a very old Hollywood vibe that I think works really well here. Leslie Mann plays Elvira as a chaos agent, which is great. And, you know, it's Dame Judi. Like, she's exquisite as always. But not the best stage-to-screen adaptation you're going to see. Like, a considerable amount of Coward's wit is sort of lost. There are laughs to be had, just maybe fewer than you might hope. But it's a lovely film to look at, and the performers are definitely going for it. You know, the purists out there may balk, but, I mean, ultimately, man, you could definitely do worse.
All right, we're talking with Alan Adams of The Main Edge, Pass the Popcorn on Downtown. How about the latest starring gig for Friend of Downtown, Gary Tangway? Oh, yes, with Rosamund Pike and Peter Dinklage, too, in I Care a Lot.
Rich, like, this movie's really good. Like, it's really good. Like, I wasn't sure. Like, I hadn't really heard anything about it until the Golden Globe nominations came out, and I saw that Rosamund Pike had been nominated for Best Actress, Musical, or Comedy. And I'm like, oh, okay. Well, I mean, the Globes are very notoriously hit or miss when it comes to this stuff, but okay. And it's this, like, dark comedy is so hard. Like we all do it. Like, we all have that tendency towards looking for humor in the shadows. Like, it's what we do. It's a way to cope with the sort of the negative things out there. But putting that on screen effectively is really hit or miss. When it lands, like, you got something that's both really funny and really unsettling, but when it misses, you're just left with the latter, and that's no good.
Mm.
But this movie hits. It's written and directed by Jay Blakeson, currently streaming on Netflix, and it gets a lot of laughs from a very grim place. Like, it takes a special kind of commitment to the bit to look at the clearly broken and often unseemly world of professional, like, court-appointed guardianship and think, you know what? That's hilarious. But they do it. Now, it certainly helps that Rosamund Pike is just on fire in this movie. Like, she is peak of her powers. She's, like, I'm just, it's more than enough to keep this particular fire burning. Like, even as we get deeper into the sort of unsavory nature of the world in which she operates, like it's one of those movies where no one's a good person. Like, and it's so rare for one of those, for a movie like that to really work. And even though there's nobody for us to root for, like, we keep laughing. And yeah, these laughs are maybe coming from the more cynical parts of ourselves, but, you know, even if you feel bad for laughing, like, you still laugh. So the Pike views, she plays Marla Grayson, who views herself as, we learn right from the get-go, she considers herself a predator in a world of prey. Like, she makes her living as a professional court-appointed guardian for elderly and infirm people, with help from, like, a team of, like, shady doctors and even shadier assisted living facility directors. She convinces judges to put people into her care, who she then cuts off from their families and sells off their stuff and empties their bank accounts. Like, that's dark. Like, a dark place to start. And so she gets a hot tip from one of her doctors that she's got a live one, a very wealthy woman with no family, no heirs, who is starting to show the occasional hint of memory issues. And this is, it's one of those, they even have a name for it. Like, they call this kind of person a cherry, like someone ripe for the picking who won't be missed. And so when they get an assist from the doctor and a crooked rest home director, makes her case in front of a very well-meaning but naive judge, and assumes responsibility for the life of this woman who has no interest in any of this. But Marla shows up on the doorstep of Jennifer Peterson, played wonderfully by Diane Weiss, and is like, yeah, you're coming with me. Like, I control all your stuff now. And they take her and stick her in a home. And that is supposed to be that. But it turns out, Rich, that there's a lot more to Jennifer Peterson than meets the eye. Because there is someone who's going to miss Jennifer Peterson. Someone with very little interest in being in the public eye, yet powerful enough to send high-powered lawyers to try and undo what Marla has done. Someone willing to send armed thugs into an old person's home to do what the lawyers can't. Someone like Roman, played just chef's kiss magnificently by Peter Dinklage, who's an extremely wealthy criminal who has his own reasons for wanting Jennifer Peterson where he can keep an eye on her. But Marla won't concede. Like, even with all the high-powered lawyers, even with the crazy gunfire in the old person's home, like, she refuses to cave. And with nothing more than a bob haircut, a tight smile, and a just incredible understanding of the intricacies of family law, like, she's going to cash in as fully as she can, consequences be damned. But there are consequences. Now, this movie works in the way that a lot of the best really dark comedy works, in that, like, it could have easily been a very straightforward, although maybe a little over the top, like, dramatic film, and still, like, functioned. But instead, we're mining the bleak reality of the situation for laughs. Like, again, cynical, uncomfortable laughs, but laughs. And sure, the film's timeline and internal logic get a little wonky by the end, but you won't care, because you'll be having so much fun just hating everybody in this movie. You know, by treating the corrupt bureaucracy of this machine as fodder for comedy, like, we're given a degree of insight that maybe we wouldn't have gotten. Like, these aren't evil for the sake of evil people. They're grifters or con artists or useful idiots. Like, there's nuance buried within the film's sort of absence of nuance, if that makes any sense. Like, it just acknowledging the fundamental absurdity of it all kind of turns the tragic into the comedic. you know, and yeah, there are the occasional feints towards commentary on like classism and sexism and stuff, but that stuff's fairly fleeting. But again, all of this, all of these, you know, big ideas and insights are in service to the much more basic picture. It's a story of terrible people doing terrible things, usually to other terrible people. And leading the way, as far as terrible, is Pike, who, again, I can't stress enough, is just outstanding in this movie. It's like there's this weird, brittle iciness to her that she retains throughout. Like, even when she smiles, it's kind of predatory. Like, it never touches her eyes. Like, it, she just paints this portrait of selfish self-assuredness. Like, the kind of person who will do literally anything to win, no matter what the game is. But, you know, and then you've got supporting cast, like Dinklage is great, and Diane Wiest is wonderful, and there are a couple of other wonderful supporting turns throughout that are really good. But, I mean, ultimately, it boils down to what Rosamund Pike is doing. And what Rosamund Pike is doing is being awesome. So, yeah. Like, look, this movie's not going to work for everyone, because it is tricky, embracing a story when almost everybody is legitimately a bad person. But because of the incredible amount of talent here, we can engage with the characters even as we wish the absolute worst upon them. And that, my friends, that is a successful dark comedy.
All right. And finally, we wrap it up with a much-talked-about new film that stars Frances McDormand and friend of downtown David Strathairn. Tell us about Nomadland.
We'll get this out of the way first. This is a GD masterpiece. Rich, like, this is an incredible movie. I'm always intrigued to watch movies that sort of blur the lines between fiction and truth. And I'm not talking about based on or inspired by or anything like that. Although, you know, one could argue that they do their own blurring of lines. But I'm talking about films that kind of fold together the real world and the fictional. Like, films that, I struggle to articulate this, but like films that evoke that sort of cinema verite documentary vibe without actually being documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's vague, and I'm not doing a great job of articulating it, but you know it when you see it. And that's what this movie is. Chloe Zhao written this Nomadland. Chloe Zhao wrote this movie, directed it, edited it, produced it. Like, this is a Chloe Zhao joint from top to bottom. It's adapted from the 2017 nonfiction book Nomadland, Surviving America in the 21st Century, written by Jessica Bruder. And it's, in the specific, it's a story about the sort of road-roaming lifestyle adopted by an increasing number of people, like older middle-class folks who have been forced out of their homes and into this sort of nomadic lifestyle by the unfortunate realities of late stage capitalism. Like, the companies for whom they spent years working are gone. Their homes and savings were destroyed by the mortgage crisis or the banking crisis, you know, and they're to survive. Like, they move into vans and RVs and they follow seasonal work. You know, they go to Amazon distribution centers and campgrounds and national parks and gradually kind of become part of this ever growing subculture. But in the general, I mean, it's a movie about America. I'm usually loath to sort of toss out pronouncements like that, but it really is that sort of thing. But what it also is, aside from the aforementioned absolutely incredible Frances McDormand and David Strathairn, everybody else in the movie is a real person. Like, these are people who are basically playing lightly fictionalized versions of themselves, like people who actually live this sort of nomadic lifestyle. And so when you have that crossover, these incredibly talented actors working with people it's not even like they're amateur actors, they're non-actors. And when you bring together that sort of fictional and factual, like, that's what pushes this movie into the realm of greatness. Like, this is an intimate epic of the American West as experienced by those who've been left behind, you know, and it's quiet and expansive all at once. It's enamored of the broad openness of the landscape while gently acknowledging how easy it is for individuals to get lost in that sort of vastness. So the basic gist is Fern, played by McDormand, spent much of her life living and working in a small company town in Nevada. After her husband passes and the plant that she worked at, that basically was the lifeblood of the town, closes, she basically rids herself of the majority of her things and takes to the road. she lives in a van and follows seasonal work from place to place. And again, there's a whole subculture of people just like her living the same life. Now, she's a loner, but she gradually starts making friends among the folks she encounters and re-encounters along the way. One of the first is there's a woman named Linda May, who's this sort of kind older woman who shows her the ropes a little bit early on. She's the one who encourages Fern to go to the Rubber Tramp Rendezvous, which is an actual thing. It's an annual meetup in the Arizona desert of all of these sort of vehicular nomads organized by this guy named Bob Wells, who basically devotes his life to supporting and helping these people, his fellow sort of nomads, transients, by, you know, helping to build community and all these other practices. And this is where she meets some of the other folks who kind of drift in and out of her life. There's a woman named Swanky, this sort of road warrior, very bristly but heart of gold, sort of is one of the first to chastise Fern for being unprepared, even as she helps fix whatever problems are happening. And then we meet Dave, and that's David Strathairn. He's a, you know, an older fella who she encounters repeatedly at these various campsites and parking lots. Like, right from the beginning, it's very clear that he digs her, but she's very content with the solitude of her life, and so their paths keep crossing and uncrossing and crossing and uncrossing as we travel through the weeks and months. And that's really kind of it. Like, we travel with her as she sort of makes the circuit, whether she's, you know, working at an Amazon warehouse or cleaning up at an RV campground or doing maintenance at a National Park Visitor Center or harvesting beets at the annual beet harvest. Like, and all the while, she's just living in her van. You know, she's existing in this constant state of transition. And it's only when the opportunities to end that lifestyle arise that we really see her considering, you know, is she doing this because she has to or because she wants to? Again, like I said, just a masterpiece. I mean, easily one of the best of the 2020s, easily one of the best of the 21st century. Like, I mean, it's so good. Like, it's this rare combination of technical skill and creative vigor and experimental verve. Like, you just don't get movies like this very often. You know, it's a gift. It's funny, and I thought about it. It's the kind of movie that reminds me of how lucky I am that I get to do this for a living. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, to the idea of being able to talk about a movie that's this good. It's just, you know, and this is Chloe Zhao's third movie. Like, that blows my mind that someone so young and with such relative lack of experience is able to just, the delicate touch, the aesthetic acumen, just, you know, there are people who spend decades in the business making films, like acclaimed, award-winning films, really talented, driven people who have never come close to making a movie like this. Like, this, we're talking about a generational talent. And I find it both incredibly weird and incredibly exciting that her next movie is an MCU movie. Hmm. Like, she was going from the set of this movie to work on pre-production for Eternals. Like, she was going back and forth between those two worlds while she was making this movie, which just makes it more impressive as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's, people have mixed feelings about the sort of the tendency to hand the keys to these various franchise films to young auteurs. But to my mind, having a director this young and talented, a female director no less, is only going to benefit the MCU writ large. But yeah, it's like, she just captures the sort of haunting nature of the American West that is just both beautiful and kind of sad, like just almost a reflection of the hole so many of these people are trying to fill. Like, just making something that feels so epic in scale while still so insular and intimate, like, I don't even know how that's possible. And yet, and here we are. And leave that, just leaves aside the fact that we're talking about a film that is populated almost entirely with non-actors. Like, these are real people, and they are just enchanting to watch. It's so often when you see a movie like this, the gap between actor and non-actor is just, it's too wide. It's too wide to cross, and things get uneven. But that never happens here, never. And that might be the most impressive thing about the whole thing, unless the most impressive thing is Frances McDormand, because holy crap, is she outstanding in this movie. Like, she's one of our absolute best actresses. Like, we're talking a 2-time Oscar winner. She's got 2 Emmys, a Tony. And Rich, I honestly think this might be the best thing that she's ever done.
Wow.
Like, to be this captivating with such an interior performance is just incredible. Like, radiates this emotion, evoking all these feelings, despite there are long stretches where she rarely speaks. And that's not just when she's on screen alone, although there's plenty of that. Her generosity as a performer is the key to all of this, because she anchors these scenes and just gives her partner, like, it's just, it's a masterclass on how to listen that she does. And it really gives these scene partners, particularly the non-actors, this wonderful opportunity to shine. Like, they just are, and she just lifts them up and lets them sort of, you know, and lets them shine. It's just incredible. And again, you know, Strathairn is great in his usual understated way. He's doing a lot with a little. He's the foil that the character of Fern needs, even as he kind of seems content to completely be. And he's charming, and they have a wonderful, quiet chemistry, he and Frances McDormand. But again, just great. Like, I can't stress enough how good this movie is. Like, it's earnest, it's honest, sympathizes but never pities, champions but never idolizes. It's just unfailingly genuine and packed with truth. Just a masterful work from a masterful talent.
Can't wait to see it. A lot of good options this week on Pass the Popcorn. Alan, we thank you as always, and we'll check in with you on Wednesday.
Yeah, we'll be talking it's the Golden Globes preview next on Wednesday, so we'll be talking more movies.
Excellent. Sounds good. Thanks, Al.
All right.